Hello and welcome to Skeptical Yours, where thinking is free. Today's episode brought to you by The Big Bang.
Boom.
Sitting next to me is my co-host and producer, Heather Henderson.
Hi, everybody.
You know Heather from the Facebooks, from the No God Band, and from our other award-winning podcast, Ardent Atheists. You can find links to our guests' website, join our Twitter and Facebook feeds, subscribe to our premium 90-minute full-length episodes on our email at skepticalyours.net.
If you'd like to take part in the live chat moderated by the author of the blog, Comedy Obscura, Joe Swam, go to skepticallyyours.net/live and chat us up right now.
And please go to iTunes, subscribe to our podcast for free, write a review, help us get up there in the top 10 where you've never put us. You may also go to skepticallyyours.net/premium and subscribe to our premium ad-free content for a measly $10 per year.
Subscribe now and you will receive $10
million. $10 million? You don't have that kind of money.
Well, the listeners don't know that.
Well, they do now.
Okay, well, subscribe now and you will receive $50 million.
You don't have $50 million?
Stop ratting me out.
I'll never understand you.
Okay, how's this? Subscribe now, and Emery will give you $100 million.
Okay, are you out of your mind?
Looks like we just got a new subscriber.
Oh, shit.
If you're a listener who's ever been duped by anything that's been debunked on Snopes, welcome. Your ordeal is over.
We're coming to you live from the amazing meeting in Las Vegas, Nevada. Woo! In the podcast suite tonight, we have Dr. Stephen Novella, Robert Novella, Jay Novella, and Evan Bernstein, out of nowhere. We got the...
How the hell did I get in here?
What the hell happened there? We are on a roll.
Leave it to me to bust things up.
Welcome, guys. Thank you for being here.
You know these folks from the world of reason.
You do. These are leaders in the world of reason, these guys. You guys...
Lead us, oh, powerful leaders.
Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, the premier skeptic podcast.
How did you get here? How did we get...
We took the elevator.
You guys rehearsed that a lot.
I was going to say evolution.
That's the slow way.
See, my mom and dad got together, the rest is history.
When a man and woman love each other very much.
Or just enough. So I'm really excited to have you guys on the show. Huge, huge fans of your work. Absolutely.
Thank you.
We do dick jokes. You guys do science.
Yeah, you guys do the real work. We just make fun of people. Yeah.
Well, the dick jokes are cut out. Steve doesn't allow those.
Oh!
I let the occasional dick trick through. Yeah.
And for the record, there's one guy here with a suit and tie.
Yeah, just one.
Stephen Novella.
He's the only one with a PhD.
He's the fucking doctor in the group, right. Isn't he?
Or he lost a bet.
MD.
He lost a bet. He's got to represent.
Yeah?
We call him Dr. Motherfucker.
Yeah? There you go. All right. Now, I have wanted for a long time to talk to you, and I've heard you talk about this, but I wanted to... I was in a serodiscordant relationship, Stephen, and it was...
Please explain that to the people who are stupid like me.
I'm HIV negative, she was HIV positive.
Okay, get it.
You know? Played safe, oral safe, we never tested consistently. Mm-hmm. Poly relationship, so protecting others in that sense, you know what I mean? Very, 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 very moral with regard to that. Within a couple of years of being public about our relationship, her name was Lainey, I would talk about this in public settings, and all of a sudden, every few months, somebody sends an email telling her they're trying to kill you. Mm-hmm. The HIV meds, the AZT, the stuff that was making her healthy, that was keeping her... She never, ever had... It was always undetectable. As long as I was in a relationship...
Her viral load was undetectable.
Viral load was undetectable, which... AZT is amazing. It's turned a deadly disease into a manageable issue.
Right.
Are they still out there putting people in at grave risk?
Absolutely, yeah. So back in the 1980s, when HIV was first discovered and the disease was first coming to public awareness, we had no idea. We started with zero knowledge about what this mystery disease was. This is really one of the huge science success stories of our lifetime. Went from knowing nothing to discovering the virus, really understanding how it works, how it decommissions the immune system. AZT was the first drug that was kind of off the shelf, that was already in existence, that we had some antiretroviral activity.
It had been developed for other purposes.
Helped a little bit, you know. But then we developed heart therapy, the highly active antiretroviral therapy drugs, and tweaked the cocktail over the last 20 years until we got to the point where the life expectancy of somebody who was HIV positive, who was on full medication, especially early on, from the early on in the infection is really not significantly different than somebody who is HIV negative. We've essentially cured the disease as far as its negative effects. They're still HIV positive, but your viral loads may be undetectable, and you don't get any opportunistic infections. You don't develop AIDS. You know, you have HIV, but you don't go on to develop fully blown AIDS. It's cured, I mean, for all intents and purposes. Amazing success story. Now, throughout this whole period of time, there have been HIV deniers, that we call them, that denied that HIV exists or denied that HIV causes AIDS. They argued that it's an incidental virus, or we don't really prove that it existed, or that the medications don't work, or that it's the medications which are causing the
That was the wild one. That was the one. That was the more common one. Is they've infected her with this so that they can make money off these drugs?
Well, where are these people getting these ideas from?
Well, I mean, there are a couple of researchers out there who are way on the fringe who are saying this, and they become the experts of the HIV deniers.
The Wakefields, if you will.
Like the Wakefields of their field. And, you know, they are the pseudo-skeptics. They're deniers in that they'll say, like, well, show me the one paper that demonstrates that HIV exists and causes AIDS. Well, that's 100 papers. Yeah. It's not one paper. And yeah, a lot of it is inferential. That's how science works. It's like saying, show me the one fossil that proves evolution. Well, there's no such thing as one fossil that proves something as complex as evolution. And, you know, but back in the 90s, up to the early 90s, their main point was, well, you know, the life expectancy of people with HIV who are taking the medications isn't very different than people who aren't taking medications. The medications don't work. That proves that the HIV theory is wrong. Okay, well, now we've cured it. So now the criteria that you laid out there, and up to whatever, the early 1990s, we've now extended the life expectancy to almost normal,
right,
you know, basically. So then that proves it does exist, right? And they kind of faded into the background for a while, but now they're coming back.
I know, right?
It's amazing.
Do you think it's like an addiction to fear? Like people just, they go straight to the fear, and then they're like, oh yeah, this is...
It's hard for me to crawl inside the head of somebody who is such a conspiracy theorist that they could deny, you know, easily demonstrable reality.
Yeah.
You know? But some people's brains work that way. Now, whether it's genetic or cultural or social or some combination of those things, I think nobody can really say definitively. You know, I tend to think that all of those things are correct for different people. Right. It seems that there are some people who are just, their brains are just functioning in that way. Conspiracy theories have this weird hold over them. They're so compelling to them.
It is compelling. Yeah, you want to believe the crazy, right?
Like once they connect the dots, those dots are connected. It's reality to them, and you can't dissuade them. Yeah. The idea that there's this apparent pareidolia, if you will, this idea that there's a pattern that it seems to be there, but it's an illusion or random noise, that does not exist in their reality.
Yeah.
If it appears to be true, it's true.
Right.
Yeah. It's there.
And it's sad that you have people like Wakefield who, you know, did his bunk study, and then there was just thousands of people lined up to buy into it.
Right.
And it's the same with HIV denial. You know, you have a couple of scientists that come out with something that goes against what real science believes, and they're like, yep, that's the guy that I believe, and then the next thing you know, people aren't taking their meds or sending out wacky emails. Like, what the hell are they sending?
I mean, friends doing this, you know, that's what blew my mind, is friends and loved ones trying to convince Lainey to stop using a drug that's making it possible for her to live.
So that's the time when, like, we talk about like how to confront people who have these kind of beliefs. When there's something like that on the line, they're giving that kind of advice. That's where I'm like, full head on, both barrels. You've got to confront that hard.
Yeah.
Like, that's unacceptable. Yeah. You know why HIV denial really took a dip, like, after, like, the mid-1990s? Because they all died.
Right,
All of the the HIV-denying people who were HIV-positive, they all died of their disease.
Yeah. There was a magazine that was being published by people at HIV that they were HIV-deniers, and they literally all died in the magazine went away.
Right.
No one was publishing it anymore.
Wow.
Right, and then we had basically
a new
generation.
So that's a self-correcting problem.
Well, yeah, in that case, evolution that worked well, too, right?
Yeah, natural selection did its work there. There was a movie I know that had, I don't remember the title of it, I apologize for not knowing it. There was a movie that had a woman in it that was HIV positive, and before the movie made it to screen, she had died, and it was a denial movie. And still, that's the blindness of conspiracy behavior and thinking. It's just bizarre. I think it's driven largely by a desire to feel in control, and that's feels an important word there. not be, but feel yeah. like they're in control.
The illusion of control.
Yeah, that's absolutely. I think that's what drives it, and human beings need that, generally yeah. speaking.
Yeah, it's one of the fundamental desires.
Yeah.
You know, we have a yeah. desire to feel like we have some control over our environment.
Yeah. You know, maybe yeah. you know, people that are prone to these things have an over-exaggerated need of control. Yeah. So they grab on to one or two or whoever, however many conspiracy theories they love. They grab onto them, and that feeds that thing, that hole that they have in themselves. Yeah. I do agree with you, though. It is a control thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, like when you...
I call it the Trump effect.
Like when you stop taking your medicine and start eating vegetables, and you're like, I'm in control of this. Yeah. I'm going to heal this. It makes you feel better for a yeah. little while, and then things go downhill. We have a friend who did that, who had cancer, and she... decided that, you know, she wasn't going to get chemo, but she was going to take control of her situation and go research herself, right. all of the different ways to heal herself, and eventually ended up having cancer in her bones and a broken back, and she then turned around. But right. it took a while, and she could have died, but she's doing well now.
Is it wrong to want to stop the George Norris? Is it wrong to want to find a way to get these coast-to-coast shows like Norris off the air? I mean... Do you
yeah.
know what I mean?
Yeah, that's a tough question.
There's so much harm being done yeah. by the misinformation being disseminated.
Yeah, I mean, I would never take the position that we should censor free speech. Mm-hmm. That's just, you know, my personal ethic.
His speech is expensive. It ain't free.
Well, you know what I mean? I agree.
It's costing us dearly.
Yeah, I agree. But I mean, you know...
I know what you
if
mean.
Somebody wants a soapbox and spout nonsense yeah. in the street, in the square...
KKK can march. I don't care.
Yeah, the price of censoring that is too great, I think, yeah. to our liberties.
Yeah, we have to err on the side of letting...
Yeah, so
you know,
we have to just counter. Then you get up on a soapbox next to him and say, this guy's full of shit that's yeah. standing yeah. next to me. But, of course, there are soapboxes that are supposed to have a filter, yeah. like journalism or universities or journals or medical journals. There are venues which are not just open, uncensored free speech, but they are filtered, standard, you know, quality assurance type of venues.
Right.
Those are the places that we, I think, really need to hold to a very, very high standard.
Right.
And then we just need to counter... speech we don't like in the public square with our own speech. That's, I think, is the default sort of best approach to that.
It becomes infuriating, though, yeah. when you have, you know, without naming names.
New England Journal?
What was the term? No, there someone the Yellow Brick Road associated name at the end of the Yellow Brick Road, uh-huh. I want to say.
Uh-huh.
We're being sued right now, so I'm being extraordinarily careful.
I got you.
It wasn't me this time.
Yeah, yeah. You have someone like that. Who has a massive
Oz,
platform? He has a wrapped audience.
Yeah.
That you know, and he's giving good information out.
Right.
Some of his information is good.
Right.
And then there's like these spikes of horrible information on the show. And you know, what do we do about that? The only thing we can do is use the internet and use media to fight him back.
Right.
What else could we do? You're never going to get nothing that you and I could do is going to get that guy taken down. Now his colleagues can do something about that. We had recently in the news. You know, they were trying to get him disbarred.
Uh-huh.
And that's fantastic.
Right.
Disbarred for lawyers, yeah. They were trying
to get him
his Columbia de-medic. University.
They wanted to de-medic him.
Right. And they were trying to get his bosses basically to fire him from his university.
Yeah.
So but that's I think that's questionable too, you know, but in any case, at least you're saying
well, you also are martyring people in that scenario.
Yeah.
I mean,
you got
who's the guy that Wakefield. Wakefield, he moved here. I mean, I don't know why.
Well,
we
he
have
was
to
struck
get the,
off. That's legitimate because again, the state has no obligation to give a medical license to somebody who's misbehaving.
Right.
So, to the UK, what they call it is they struck him off, like the list of physicians.
Yeah.
So he no longer has a degree to practice medicine in the UK. So he came to the United States,
and he's suing people from the United States that don't even live in the United States right now, which is totally bizarre to me.
Well, he's suing people who are criticizing him to shut down their criticism. Brian Deere. That's the public domain. Yeah.
Perfect.
Why do you think it's so hard to turn people around on a subject when, say, they believe the Wakefield thing and they go on a rampage and say, you know, that vaccines are awful, and then you promote the truth and you say, hey, look, this guy's awful and this is why, and then they still...
It's complicated.
Part of it is an emotional investment and pride. You devote years to this belief and your activism, and just human psychology, it's hard to turn that switch. It hurts. It's very difficult. And that's
pride.
Why we don't see that very... Not so much pride, but you've got so much emotional investment in it that you
it is identity,
can't turn around.
I think you wrap up your identity in that. And it becomes
and your
like
worldview.
It's your worldview. It's a religion. I mean, it's like a religious belief.
George
at that
Bush could never admit that he did anything wrong after at least one person had died on his watch overseas in a war.
Right.
That's kind of the way it is, I guess.
I think people, it's motivated reasoning. I think people get themselves there because they have a desperate need of something. Yeah. And it is like we were talking before, it's filling some type of gap for them. And it's, you know, it might be making sense of a hard reality in one sense or another.
Yeah.
You know, as an example, a family, you know, loses somebody to, and you know, they're going to come up with reasons to not blame that person or whatever. Like one of my best friends died in a motorcycle accident, and you know, his family is saying things, and I'm saying it's his fault. You know, I love him,
sure,
but get off the death machine,
right?
And they're like blaming everything else, and it's like, yeah, that's making them feel better, and I think that comes into play with things.
Why you got to be a victim blamer, man?
Yeah,
you have a parent with a child with autism. Let's say
that's
Some parents can accept that this is just the you know, the hand that life dealt us.
Right, right.
Nobody's fault. It's just genetics or whatever. But some parents, like, they really want the sense of control.
Right.
Yes. And they want an answer. They want someone to, or something,
and they don't want it to be themselves.
To blame.
Right,
right.
Yeah, and they have no reason to blame themselves.
Right. That's a thing you're fighting off. What's wrong with my genetics that I, you know what
I mean? Right, right, right. Yeah. So, and I've had people tell me, there's nothing you can show me to convince me that vaccines didn't cause my child's autism. They're saying that it's a religious belief. There's like, they're immune to evidence.
Right.
Well, Ken Ham said this.
That's the Ken Ham argument.
Yeah, if you ever find yourself saying that, there's nothing you can say to convince me, you're wrong.
Yeah.
So that means you're not following a skeptical process.
Yeah.
You're holding on to this as a religious belief. But, you know, we try to educate the public at large. I mean, you definitely have to get to people before they've become that invested, before they are quote unquote true believers.
Right.
If you can get
it, does get down to education as soon as humanly possible. That's the thing.
Yeah. That's why we really, really, really want to teach critical thinking to kids. You know,
exactly.
Younger ages.
Oh, yeah. Well, let's talk about that. That's what we need to do absolutely in schools, in my opinion, and in the home as soon as possible. You're listening to Skeptically Yours on SkepticallyYours.net and available to the iTunes Store. More after this unavoidable irritation.
Good news, everyone.
That's right. Good news indeed. We have a premium ad-free service. We do the show for 90 minutes, and you'll be able to listen to the live show and or download the first hour free from iTunes. The premium service, however, will allow you to subscribe to the full 90-minute ad-free show. It's only $10 per year. If you want to support us, please go to skepticallyyours.net/premium and subscribe. What does a subatomic duck say?
What?
Quark.
That was stupid.
Foundation Beyond Belief is a community of compassionate humanists and atheists supporting outstanding charities worldwide. Members sign up for automatic donations starting at $5 a month, then distribute those funds however they wish among the featured charities. To date, this unique humanist organization has raised over $750,000 to make this world a better, more humane place. We don't look to the skies for a better world. Foundation Beyond Belief is humanity at work. Learn more or join us at foundationbeyondbelief.org.
Hi, I'm David Diskin, and I wanted to tell you about Camp Quest West. We're a secular summer camp for non-religious families, and our week-long program for kids runs this summer in locations in California and over a dozen others throughout the U.S. At Camp Quest, we give kids the traditional camp experience, like archery, swimming, arts and crafts, and campfire songs, but we add science, skepticism, humanism, and critical thinking. There's a few spots left for parents who want to register their kids, but we're also asking for your help. We turn every donation into camperships for families that can't afford to send their children to camp. We're 100% volunteer-based, a tax-exempt 501c3, and our amazing financial aid program is supported by the free thought and skeptic community by people like you. I want to see how much Emery and Heather's fans can raise for Camp Quest West. Visit tinyurl.com/ardentcampquest. Or look for the link on their Facebook page. You can learn more about our California camps and the others throughout the U.S. by visiting campquest.org.
Hey, kids. Remember the good old days of simple, wholesome fun? Back when you could watch cartoons on Saturday morning? Remember watching Mr. Peabody and Sherman use their Wayback Machine to visit the realms of ancient history? And remember how disappointing it was that they didn't fuck anybody? Didn't you want to see Mr. Peabody get his hot little doggy holes stuffed by Zebulon Pike or Galileo? Well, now you can. Only instead of a dog and an underage boy, it's two hot sorority chicks using a time machine to screw their way through history. Time Bangers is a hot new series of erotic time travel novels set for full release on July 28th. For more details, check out www.timebangers.com. You'll laugh, you'll cry, you'll come. And now back to Skeptically Yours, where thinking is free. We're talking with Dr. Stephen Novella, Robert Novella, Jay Novella, they're not doctors, and Evan Bernstein. Okay.
Please call me Bob.
All right, Bob, you got it.
Don't call him Robbie,
you got to tell
though.
Him your Bob story.
Yeah, you know, I was born Emery the first, named after my dad, Emery. And then he changed his name to Bob and just let me hang him. So now I'm the only Emery out there.
You did want to name your daughter Emery?
I did. I liked the idea. And using a last name as a first name is not necessarily gender specific. There's a fluidity to the possibility. But the girl I accidentally knocked up originally was like totally against it, so it didn't happen.
What's your middle name?
No middle name. That's an interesting story, too. At the hospital, the nurse comes in with the paperwork for mom to fill out for the birth certificate, and she left the middle name blank because there was no middle name.
Emery blank Emery. I like
that. Well, that happened. They were like, well, we got to put something in there. So they tried not applicable, N/A, I think. And she's like, no, now his name's N/A. No, you can't do that. And none. They put none in. Finally, it was all settled on. They filled it out 3 or 4 times. It was settled on --. So technically, 2 hyphens. So technically, my name is Emery-Emery.
Oh, Morse code. I like that.
Yeah, right? Right? What are 2 dashes in Morse code? Maybe that's what it is. Yeah. There we go.
Right there.
That's the first anyone's thought of that.
Thank you.
But yeah, I have friends who call me Double Dash, which... that's bizarre.
Who calls you Double Dash?
Well, a guy I used to live with, a comic I used to live with, and he got a lot of people kind of hooked on it. So, all right, we were talking as we left. We were talking about education. Mm-hmm. And that's something, I mean, again, I do dick jokes. I have no idea how to change our world in a profound way by getting schools, and I'm thinking high schools is not it. I think it's grade school.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Am I right?
I think it's every level.
It's everywhere.
There's no magic moment, but I think you got to start young and keep going all the way through.
I don't know.
And even adult education.
I mean,
just the whole lifelong education and critical thinking.
And there should be a critical thinking class.
Yes.
In our curriculum,
absolutely.
Am I right?
Yeah. I mean, today, you know, students only get critical thinking from essentially a teacher here and there.
Yeah.
But there's no formal class that they should just cook it into, you know, at least every other grade or whatever, give them the basics, and then you can get it more nuanced as they go older, and forget it in college. It's just never going to happen.
Yeah.
Right.
But at
least
they have Camp Quest now. I mean, at least some kids are getting
family,
some.
Individual families are concerned with it, and that's just the skeptic world, you know, that's us. We got to get it everywhere. We're going to get all kinds of pushback, and by we, I mean the people who do this, not me. They're going to get all kinds of pushback from religion, right?
Always.
Well, yeah, but the thing is, I mean, what we're really talking about, if you're talking about like K-12 education, you just have to convince the education community that this is the way it needs to be done. They already understand that you need to teach quote-unquote critical thinking. That's already a buzzword within the education community.
And it's not a bad word in the community?
No, it's good.
That's good.
It's like they want critical thinking to be incorporated into every class. The problem is it's not really what we think of as critical thinking. You know, it's not like what the skeptical community would understand as.
What do you think that they're, what are they doing that's different?
Well, I think it ends up being like a little bit too superficial and going through the motions, you know? It's just not really
just like sex ed class going through
yeah
the
like
motions.
My daughters are going through K-12 education. You know, I have one in high school, one in grade school at this point, and you know, I've been very closely monitoring their science education, and you know, they're getting exposed to facts, and occasionally they do their experiments or their plans or whatever. But the real practical stuff where they're supposed to learn how science works is a joke. It really is just so poorly executed. So often I have to like go over it with them and help them learn what they were supposed to learn from the exercise that they didn't learn because it was handled so poorly. So it's just a shame. Like, there's such missed opportunities. So I think that it's part of it is just quality. I don't think it'd be too hard to sell to convince educators that they need to teach critical thinking.
Right.
We just need to help them do it really well. And it's hard to make that happen sort of across the board.
Yeah. Right.
And part of the problem is that the textbook industry is a mess, and the quality
outdated. And
yeah, it's just horrible.
And they're expensive.
Political
so
and expensive.
It.
It's crap. Yeah. But you know, the thing is, we don't really need textbooks because you can just put everything online
now. Right. Right?
So yeah. I have a wacky idea. I think that magic is so intriguing, especially to kids, and magic is a perfect starting point for critical thinking.
Yeah.
And I think it would be, you know, this sounds too bizarre, but wouldn't it be cool if they brought a magician in, and the magician shows tricks, gets the kids involved, and the magician then weaves in critical thinking. Let me tell you how I fooled you.
Yeah.
Let me tell you why I fooled you, how I fooled you, start getting into that type of thing. And I think kids like magic, too, because they want to know the trick.
Yeah.
There's that massive curiosity that goes with it. I think that would work.
I'm for now, this 100%.
You try to get a magician in the school, though, and see what happens.
I know, right?
Yeah. Maybe Penn & Teller will retire and do that.
Fuck Penn & Teller. Let's get Chris Angel on this, because it'll get him out of the goddamn casinos, right? And I won't have to fucking deal with his billboards.
But it'll be horrible at it.
Aren't you? He's heinous, that guy. What? It's the worst show in this town.
Yeah.
Chris Angel has the worst show in this town. If you are thinking of going to see Chris Angel, kill yourself. It's the worst show.
I wouldn't put him near my kids, though.
That's a better show. Watching yourself bleed out in a tub is a better show than watching Chris Angel do a fucking show.
But Steve's right. Now, you know, with digital media so powerful, there's a ton of resources out there. There's a lot of companies that are producing great content. Steve has his great course. There's video from all of the conferences. Yeah, it's all there.
It's all there. I mean, it's not like you can't find it. And that brings us back.
It needs to be funneled to a place that where it can be accessed.
We need good teachers.
Yes.
Not that we don't have great teachers out there. I mean, because when we talk to fantastic teachers that are in the trenches dealing with this nonsense, but managing to do a wonderful job.
Yeah.
And if there's, you know, there's like two real things that correlate with kids getting a good science education. One is that they have a fantastic science teacher. It's not their textbooks. It's nothing. None of that stuff. It's how good is their teacher. The other one is their home situation.
Right.
You know, we can't really do much about the home situation.
No.
You know.
No.
But you know, raising the bar for like having great science teachers in every science class in the country, that's like the one thing that the evidence shows would definitely work.
And that is how you fix the home problem. It's through early education and then letting the home problem die off and be replaced by well-educated people.
I don't know. I had it tough when I was a kid. I grew up in a really urban area, primarily Black and Hispanic, and I had an awesome science teacher. The problem was he was really, really good, but he was also really timid, didn't know how to deal with the rough kids. And so it all just went by the wayside. And people like me who were into it, you know, I learned from him and did well, but he couldn't, he was just so, timid that he couldn't teach to the kids that were aggressive.
I have a question for you, though.
Yes.
Did he give you the spark? Did his influence on you set you in a path at all? Like, was there any influence that stayed with you?
No. I mean, him, personally, you know, a good teacher, because we were surrounded by a ton of awful teachers, but it made me respect him, and, you know, and I got good grades because I liked him.
It was actually Richard Dreyfuss.
I didn't have a spark for science when I was that age, I did well, and I enjoyed the class.
I had a teacher that was exceptional, Mr. Hildebrandt, and I was a D student. I could not pass. I barely passed everything. You know, it was always just, you know, someone going in and making the teachers go ahead and move me to the next level. I excelled in this one specific class. There's a couple other small examples, but Mr. Hildebrandt, I couldn't read a book.
Yeah.
I did not know how to concentrate well enough. I would read a paragraph, get to the bottom of it, and be thinking about candy bars, and then have to go back to the top of the paragraph and start reading it again, because the discipline had never been put in me whatsoever. Numerous home reasons for that. But Mr. Hildebrandt was profound. I mean, we were reading a book that, and I don't even know if this is true, that this might have been Hildebrandt just being a genius. We were reading Amityville Horror, and he claimed that they didn't want us. The school wouldn't let us do it, but he fought for it. Again, to this day, I think he might have just manufactured that, which
just
is
to make it forbidden.
Genius!
Genius!
And so, and we would read it in class, and we would take turns reading a page, and then all of a sudden, I'll never forget this one night, or one day, I was in class, and we were reading, and it came to that scene with the look back up into the house, and there's flies in the window down from the boathouse, and it's just a turning point, and then smash, a desk chair just is flung across the back of the room. and he was by the, he threw it and into a bunch of empty chairs, and yeah, it was fantastic. We just shat ourselves.
See,
it
in my
was
school,
phenomenal.
Some guy would have thrown that at the teacher. Yeah. That's how it worked in my.
He was the best teacher
system.
I ever encountered, Mr. Hildebrand.
It's so true. Steve and I to this day will mention our physics and astronomy teacher in high school. I mean, I really can't remember too many high school teachers. It's so long ago. Yeah. But Mr. Coffin was such an amazing guy, such a dry sense of humor, and knew his shit, made his classes so interesting.
Yeah, like the first day in astronomy class, he said, "All right, here's your first assignment. Sketch the universe."
Holy shit, that's great. That is fantastic.
And I tried it, and he was like, "No, I'm joking. Don't actually try to sketch the universe." But how do you get guys like that in there? I mean, besides just giving teachers twice as much money as we give them now. How do you get guys?
It
like
isn't
Mr.
necessarily
Coffin
about money. Absolutely, they need to be paid. But tenure is a problem. You just can't protect bad. It's got to stop. Yeah, absolutely has to stop.
Well, how about this? Why don't we pay teachers a great wage?
That's a great idea. Period.
Let's celebrate the fact that an awesome teacher is an awesome teacher. You know, we're in a time, and you know, particularly in the United States, where everybody gets the trophy.
Yeah.
You know, it's like bullshit. That's crap.
Yeah.
Because you actually have to work to get somewhere.
Yeah.
And it takes a little, you know, today, don't even get me started on the whole young generation.
Can we also weed out the bad teachers somehow?
Yeah, I think Yelp reviews is the answer.
Yelp reviews.
Yeah. I'm not even joking when I say this. I'm saying there should be a review system and for teachers that the students are working in. They go to a place online, they review their experience of the day, and then there are people who oversee that. First of all, spelling errors in the reviews, you know you have a problem right there. I mean,
it's not a bad idea, because today what they do is they send someone in to sit in the class, right? Mm-hmm. That's, you know, well, okay, so that day the teacher ups their game or whatever because they're being observed.
Right.
Well, there's rapemyprofessor.com, which Eric 13 just
said.
Did
you say rapemyprofessor?
Not rape, not this time.
That's a whole other website, my friend.
RateMyProfessor.com, but I'm thinking elementary school teachers, too, not just
that. Yeah, everybody. That was nice. The thing that that I think makes a lot of sense is, and this is the optimist in me, I'm curious if you guys would disagree with this. I've said it many times on the show, but I ask people about this a lot. I think we're headed in a really, really, really good direction. And by that I mean, I think that we are teaching natural selection, not natural selection, critical thinking, incidentally, mm-hmm. with these devices.
Smartphones.
Yeah. So how do you mean?
It doesn't matter, in my opinion, and I could be wrong. I'm curious if anybody agrees with this. It doesn't matter if the information is right or wrong. There's multiple sources of information when you go to the web using this phone that every kid has in his hand. Every kid has this because you can also get laid and make out with people with it. And so because it's a multiple-use tool, kids, when they want to go find information, they go to the web, they use this device, and they find multiple sources of information.
Both good and bad.
Exactly. And as far as critical thinking is concerned, step one is teaching them how they have to choose, how they have to make a decision. When I was a kid, I know you'll relate to this, Jay, when we were kids, we had a book we had to go to, and that was the definitive answer.
That was it.
And generally, our parents were like, "I guess that's right." You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Now, it's not like that anymore.
Yeah, I agree. So, and this is a good hook into schools, into the education system, because, and they're sort of doing this, but they're disappointingly behind the curve, in my opinion, from my experience. So what you're saying is, all right, we have to teach the kids how to access and evaluate the information that they find online. We don't have to download information to them. We just have to teach them how to go get the information.
Right.
It's all there.
And how to parse it.
And how to parse it,
right.
How to evaluate it,
right.
How to judge it. That's all critical thinking.
That's all right.
So you could just tell schools and the system and the education system, we have to teach students how to access information online, and cooked into that is critical analysis of that information.
That's step two.
Right now, we got step one
in place.
Yeah.
They're already being conditioned for that.
Yeah.
And next is how to get the right
what's
information.
What's a good source?
What's accurate?
What's a bad source?
That's
how do you resolve different? That's all skeptical thinking.
Yeah, and I'm teaching my mom that as we speak. I mean, that's something I'm trying to teach my mom.
Not to get scammed.
That's exactly right. Right.
How's
all right,
going?
We'll be right back. I'll fill you in on that after the break. You're listening to Skeptically Yours on SkepticallyYours.net and available at the iTunes Store. More after this insufferable disruption. Have you heard of our other award-winning podcast, Ardent Atheist? Well, you have now, so go check it out. Go to www.ardentatheist.com. Pavlov is sitting at a bar when all of a sudden his phone rings. Pavlov says, "Oh shit, I forgot to feed the dogs."
Foundation Beyond Belief is a community of compassionate humanists and atheists supporting outstanding charities worldwide. Members sign up for automatic donations starting at $5 a month, then distribute those funds however they wish among the featured charities. To date, this unique humanist organization has raised over $750,000 to make this world a better, more humane place. We don't look to the skies for a better world. Foundation Beyond Belief is humanity at work. Learn more or join us at foundationbeyondbelief.org.
Hi, I'm David Diskin, and I wanted to tell you about Camp Quest West. We're a secular summer camp for non-religious families, and our week-long program for kids runs this summer in locations in California and over a dozen others throughout the U.S. At Camp Quest, we give kids the traditional camp experience, like archery, swimming, arts and crafts, and campfire songs, but we add science, skepticism, humanism, and critical thinking. There's a few spots left for parents who want to register their kids, but we're also asking for your help. We turn every donation into camperships for families that can't afford to send their children to camp. We're 100% volunteer-based, a tax-exempt 501c3, and our amazing financial aid program is supported by the free thought and skeptic community by people like you. I want to see how much Emery and Heather's fans can raise for Camp Quest West. Visit tinyurl.com/ardentcampquest. Or look for the link on their Facebook page. You can learn more about our California camps and the others throughout the U.S. by visiting campquest.org.
Hey, kids, remember the good old days of simple, wholesome fun? Back when you could watch cartoons on Saturday morning? Remember watching Mr. Peabody and Sherman use their Wayback Machine to visit the realms of ancient history? And remember how disappointing it was that they didn't fuck anybody? Didn't you want to see Mr. Peabody get his hot little doggy holes stuffed by Zebulon Pike or Galileo? Well, now you can. Only instead of a dog and an underage boy, it's two hot sorority chicks using a time machine to screw their way through history. Time Bangers is a hot new series of erotic time travel novels set for full release on July 28th. For more details, check out www.timebangers.com. You'll laugh, you'll cry, you'll come.
And now back to Skeptically Yours, where thinking is free. We're talking with Dr. Stephen Novella, Robert Novella, Jay Novella, and Evan Bernstein.
Hey, lady.
So great.
Nice
so
lady.
Great. And you all three are brothers. You're not a brother. You're
I feel like a brother.
He's our brother,
I know,
from
you
another
guys
mother.
Yeah. Brother
say.
From
yes,
another
that's
mother.
Right, yeah.
That's so
our
hip.
It is. He's our virtual brother.
I'm the Tom Hayden to the Corleones.
Yeah.
Boy. Whoa. That sounds deadly.
Well, you know, in a general sense.
Right. So we were talking during the break. We were talking about education, and you were saying. You were saying, Evan, that you took your child out of sixth grade.
Yeah, my daughter started sixth grade this year, got about halfway through, and she was having a lot of problems at school. Mainly, she wasn't retaining the material that she was supposedly, you know, being taught and learning. And we were trying to figure out why. We had a lot of one-on-ones with all the teachers, the principal. I mean, we must have had a half dozen meetings about this and tried some different things. And what it turns out is that, you know, the teachers just were not, as far as we were concerned, filling their end of the bargain. Yeah. And they were trying to place blame, frankly, on Rachel, my daughter.
That's what
and
they do.
We got so fed up with it, we said, this is enough. We yanked her out, and now we are homeschooling her. She now goes to an online academy at home. Where, because my wife works at home, we have the advantage that she can be her, home teacher.
Her monitor.
Yeah, her monitor,
yeah.
Basically.
Yeah. So
and
which
she takes all her classes online now.
So which religious system are you plugged into then?
Yeah, right, exactly.
This is the first time I've ever heard a skeptic, a science-minded person talk about homeschooling.
Yeah.
This is kind of new and fresh in my head.
It gets a bad rep,
right.
Homeschooling.
Well, we wanted to give this a try, and we're going to evaluate this to see how she does by the end of it to see if she's actually made progress.
Right.
She's about halfway done now through sixth grade. Yes, she is. She does need to take school through the summer in order to sort of catch up, per se,
right.
Although there is technically no catch-up. You can kind of really go at your own pace. So far, the results have been very, very impressive.
Oh, that's
and
great.
This is just to clarify, this is a secular homeschooling.
Yeah.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, it's not a
secular.
Religious.
No, it's not. No, it's not. And she's taking classes with kids from all over the world.
Yeah.
She's who all speak English. It's all English-based, and this company that runs it is based out of Virginia. But students from Russia, from China, from India. She's actually meeting all these really, really great kids and doing online interactions with them and all sorts of stuff.
That was the thing I was going to say. The thing you lose with homeschooling that might be really important, and I say might because I might be wrong. Probably I'm probably wrong. But the socialization aspect. Because really it seems like that's what schools are all actually only for, generally.
Sure, but she's still involved with the community. I mean, she still takes like her martial arts classes, and she sees her friends there, and she still has play dates with her neighbors and kids around. She's getting all of that.
Socialization she needs.
She is absolutely getting all that. That has not been sacrificed one bit.
Wow.
Is this really homeschooling, though? Because to me, it's more online schooling, not homeschooling.
Well, legally it's homeschooling, but it's through with online resources.
But say people that typically are homeschooled, whether they're religious or not, do they have a big online component as well?
I always
pictured the mom and
sitting
the dad,
there with books.
Right.
Well, that is the Bible. I think the vast majority of people do
homeschool. Classic Jesus rode on the dinosaurs, and
I mean, certainly before the internet, that's what it was. You get the resources at home, and it's the mom or whatever, the dad teaching the child at home. But now online, why wouldn't you do that?
Right.
But this really is, Bob, you're right. This really is online learning. You know, maybe homeschooling gives people the wrong sort of knee jerk reaction. Actually, right now, my wife is going through a hybrid online PhD program.
It's a hybrid. Yeah. So there's a massive shift right now when we're living in it where we're seeing it's going to become okay to have an online degree.
Yeah, it's not there. We're not there yet. Yeah. And I still know professors and who have some who have stated this position publicly and even within our community that, like, no, online learning is still crap. But I disagree. I think that there's advantages and disadvantages. And I think we are going to evolve towards a system where we get the best that online resources have to offer. Like, for example, why have somebody give a didactic, you know, course, just a passive lecturing course on some material, when you can have the world's best person doing that do it? You could watch a video of the best version of that exists.
Right.
Why have the local schmuck in your school do it? Not to disparage it, but I'm just saying, just chances are you don't have the best guy in the world at your local school. But you can go online and get the best course. So universities have less and less to offer students in terms of just lectures. That's not a commodity that they really control.
And ironically, the prices are going up and up.
Well, that's
crazy.
A different issue. They have to provide something other than that.
Right.
And that's why there's this big push now, also because the evidence supports this is better for active learning, where you have to have practicals and workshops and interaction and something hands-on, because that's something you can't fully do online. Although I think we'll get better at doing that online
as well. At some point, you actually have to cut into a cadaver to become a doctor.
Well, yes. Oh, yeah, absolutely. But, like at Yale, where I teach medicine, our students, first of all, the younger generation, they don't want to sit in a classroom and listen to somebody talk at them in front of a classroom.
Right.
They're done with
that. We're going to look back at this as a wildly archaic.
Yes. They want to listen to podcasts.
Yeah.
They want to read articles online. They want to look on their iPhone. You know, they want to consume the information they have to learn electronically, because that's how they consume all their information.
Which ties into what we talked about before, how to get the kids to learn how to search for good and bad things online.
But here,
I've seen that improvement.
If they're being fed it, like even if it's like, here's the Yale, the online resources we want you to go to. But when you get them physically into a classroom, there's a patient there. You know, there's something physically there to interact with, or it's a workshop, you know. Yeah. But there's no point anymore to having kids sit in a classroom and have somebody lecture at them.
Technology is changing the landscape. Yeah. So a huge thing. We're going to look back in 10 years, and we'll listen to this podcast, and you'll be like, Jay was right. Virtual reality is going to change the way we learn things.
I'll already say Jay is right. I completely agree with
this. All these companies are coming out with their version
one. You put on the helmet. We won't have to cut a cadaver, literally.
Well, you could have virtual patients.
Yeah.
You could make sure, rather than hit or miss, you could make sure a student gets every experience they need to have in order to really learn the principles.
Isn't that what the game Operation was like? You know, you tweezers and you pull the wishbone out.
And Evan alluded to another aspect of it, which I think is so important, is that every individual could learn at their own pace.
Yeah.
If you fall, it's not like if you fall behind, you're done for that whatever lecture or that class. It's you know, when you get the concept, you go on to the next one. When you get that concept, you go on to the next one.
Right.
I mean, the advantages are so huge. So yeah, I think we are at the beginning of a revolution in education because of online, virtual, you know, electronic learning that will be incorporated into the mentorship and the practical aspects of you still need a person who knows
right?
shit
yes.
teaching
right.
you and mentoring you, but not wasting their time telling the same lecture over and over again.
Right.
You know, they got to bring something more to the table than that.
Yeah, but Steve, I'm just waiting until we can download the information and
just jack into your head
in 10 seconds. That's
that will give you
facts,
but then you still have to learn how to think. Like when I'm teaching medical students, I'm rarely teaching them facts. Only if I need to like fill something in so that they know what we're talking about. I'm teaching them how to think. How to think about diagnoses, about patients, about risks and benefits, whatever. I assume that they will learn the facts they need to learn through all their other resources. They don't need me to read them a textbook. They need me to tell them how to think about that information. That's what the real role of a mentor or teacher is. Even if you're downloading it directly into your brain, you still need somebody with experience to tell you how to use that information.
Not if I'm downloading the porn.
Yeah, well, that's true.
Well, you know,
I got that covered, Emery.
I just remember graduating high school going, gosh, you know, if I had just read the book, answered the questions, I would have made eight straight A's because it didn't matter. Thinking and learning didn't matter. It was digesting the information that they gave me and spitting it right back out.
That was that Goodwill Hunting scene where he says, "You spent $200,000 for an education I got with a fucking library card.
Right.
You know, I read all your textbooks. They're free in a library.
Yeah.
What did you really get for your money?" And in a way, he's right.
And I'm still paying my student loans.
Yeah.
How do you like them apples?
It's a cart before the horse question. Most of the smartest people in my circle and that I know, most autodidacts.
Just avid
you know
readers.
What I mean?
Yeah.
And
absolutely.
I wonder if it's kind of a mix, right? I mean, are they wired to learn? Everything I learned on my own. I didn't learn it from a school. I didn't learn it through the basic processes. I library card, online, you name it. That's where I learned. And it was all information that I wanted to learn. Everything they made me want, they forced me to learn. I had no interest. I don't give a shit about certain things, you know, history. So the question is, are people who are driven to be autodidacts, are they just taking the reins themselves, or is it both? Is the process of learning what you're interested in on your own, is it more effective? It's probably a mixture of both.
Yeah, I think it's a mixture of both.
Yeah.
You know, there are some things people have to learn, but certainly there's nothing that beats the motivation to learn on your own. When you want to understand something because it's interesting to you, you will do what it takes to wrap your head around that idea or that concept. You will seek out the information. You'll absorb it. You know what I mean? So there's just no substitute for that. But we still have to teach kids things that they need to know, even if it's not what they're most interested in. So you have to do some of that sort of forcing kids to learn some basics.
Yeah.
But I think we need to incorporate that. To give you my medical school analogy, because there I have very highly motivated students because they want to learn because this is their freaking job.
Right.
Yes. They don't want to be in a situation where they're treating a patient. They don't know what they're doing. They're highly motivated and appreciative of the learning that we give them, and we're teaching them how to get information on their own. This is how you look up information. You know, 5 years from now, everything I could teach you now will be obsolete.
Yeah.
You need to learn how to constantly learn new information, how to access it, how to access it quickly, how to digest it quickly, how to decide what the quality of the study is, how to incorporate that into your thinking.
And that's the toughest part. Even in the skeptic world, getting people to understand and figure out how to find reliable information.
I fucking love science.com, IFLScience.com. Do you guys know about that website?
Sure.
Yeah. And how, like, some articles are right and good, and then others are just, what the fuck? Like, how do you...
And can we rely on these kind of aggregate solutions, you know? Like,
no, you have to do it. You always have to parse it out yourself.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, if we're relying on someone to tell us this is good and this is bad, then
we're just substituting one authority for another.
We're in danger again, right?
Yeah, as we tell people, don't believe us. Don't trust us. We want you to think for yourselves. And if you think we're wrong, tell us. You know, no one's the absolute authority, really, on anything. It's just... You know, I'm not saying don't listen to people who have experience or expertise in an area that you don't have.
Yeah, like Deepak, if he's talking about quartz.
At least have...
Is that the duck joke again?
Call back to the duck joke.
You need to have the ability to evaluate the quality of the information for yourself.
Yeah.
You know, there's just no substitute for that. Otherwise, yeah. You're just completely vulnerable, you know.
How is that taught? And I know that's an impossible question to answer, but is there any hint in how that's taught to kids? Are there systems
in place? Is it being taught, or how should it be taught?
That's the question. How should it be taught?
Yeah, I think we've been talking about that for, you know, for the last 20 minutes, that I think you give them like tasks to evaluate for themselves.
Okay.
And like the good teachers, like, and I've seen this done with my daughters as well, like when they get a good teacher, they say, like, go online, find a news item, and then you're going to deconstruct that news item.
That's brilliant.
Yeah, that's a great way to teach stuff.
Right.
It's active learning. That's great. Or, like, I think teaching pseudoscience is a great way to teach science. Hmm. And the evidence supports that, actually.
That's great.
The evidence supports that.
Okay.
Because if you don't, then even if you teach just straight-up science, they still can't distinguish science from pseudoscience.
Right.
You don't know what to look for.
You have to teach them about pseudoscience as well.
Right.
Or, you know, Bob and I love this physics course from the Great Courses. Again, just a great didactic lecture that anybody could listen to, where they go through the history of how our thinking evolved on physics. You know, it's like, not here is what we know, but this is the thought process historically that led us to this, and this is why this is the only way to think about it, because all the other ideas that were explored and abandoned, and you really reproduce the thought process that led us to our current understanding. That's how you teach it.
Right, here's a mystery. Nobody knew the answer. They thought they had a physics down, but except for a couple little mysteries of physics, they thought they had it all nailed, but those couple of mysteries turn into quantum mechanics and relativity.
And people love mysteries.
I love it. Great story.
Yeah. I love documentaries that start with a mystery.
Yeah.
And then it's a detective story. It's science, but it's like, where are these gamma rays coming from?
Yeah.
Scientists don't know. And this is what they did. This was their first hypothesis. That turned out to be wrong. You know. And then they lead you through, and it's like, at the end, you really get it, because you get the process.
Yeah, eventually, ancient alien theorists explain it
to us. Yeah, you don't just get the answer with something like
that. I want to kill that guy.
Yeah.
Do you guys think that science will kill religion?
No.
That's a really good question.
No, absolutely not. No, but I mean, religion is really... Sadly, it's needed. It's a requirement for certain people's psychology, I think. I think we could do a much better job of reducing the number of true believers out there, but I think as long as the human brain is the way it is today, you know, if we don't go into the singularity, I think there's always going to be some type of religion there to comfort people and to answer questions.
Well, I think some kind of religion is the key there. So, yeah. But I think science... to some degree, is killing traditional religions.
I see.
Yeah. If you look at the long course of history, like go back 200 years, we were way more religious than we are today.
Right.
Like the long arc of human history is less religion. Yeah. Absolutely. And those religions that exist are trampling science less, because science is displacing
thanks to the internet and, you know,
there's no question that scientific answers are displacing religious answers on scientific questions.
We'd have to agree on what killing it means, too. I mean,
yeah, that's what I'm saying. Yeah. So, but I do think, but at the same time, so as traditional religions are on the wane and they're trampling science less, but spiritual ideas, like New Age ideas, are sort of filling the gap. And then you have like alternative medicine is kind of a New Age religion for people now. And so I do think
it's
morphing. Paul Kurtz wrote about the transcendental temptation,
right?
The idea, this is just part of our makeup, that this desire to be transcendent above the physical, mundane, muddy universe, it may be just baked into our brains.
Yeah. And Cargill Cults really pointed out well.
We do have to deal with that probably forever. But I do think that we could really significantly marginalize it.
Like
muzzle it.
Let's get religion out of our government, out of our schools, out of the big things that that run our
society. It's going to take a lot of trains.
Yeah, that reminds me, I was reading Arthur C. Clarke's A Space Odyssey, 3000, right? Like I think the last with 3001, and very cool story. But in that story, science has advanced to such a point that religion was basically dead. And I always thought that was naive. It's never going to be fully dead. There's always going to be something.
It seems to me like
that around.
Yeah, it seems to me like we're maybe when you just look at the arc you were talking about, how when you look at 500 year chunks, 300 year chunks, it's always better.
Yeah.
By every metric, it's always better. Yeah. Virtually every.
We're getting better at being human, you know, our civilization.
It's always better. So it seems to me that we are a handful of generations away from all problem religions. Let's put it that way. You know what I mean? I mean, my friends who are Buddhists are fucking harmless. There's just nothing there that I concern myself with.
It's barely a religion.
And that's the point.
That's exactly right. Yes. I mean, the only real problem with Buddhism is the abject poverty that it promotes in some of the strongholds where it is. But that's going away, you know. So the lazy Buddhists aren't a problem. The
Unitarians
aren't a problem. Yeah. What will eventually happen?
Fundamentalists.
Is,
so if you say the death of fundamental religion,
that's what she's
I would
talking
love
about.
To say yes.
I would
can,
love
we can
to
see the
that
death of fundamental die, religion yeah. and replaced by. But
they'll be pushed into little islands like the Amish. That's what I think we're going to see. They're going to have to. They'll coalesce or coagulate, as I prefer to say, and they'll find their own little places to be, which will be fine, and everybody will let them do that because we're a free nation, and that will be great. And get the hell out of politics and social daily interaction. That's what I think that could happen. And then we'll have spiritual potheads a lot. And that's,
I'm concerned
we'll
about the southern states in our country, though, because they're so culturally embedded there.
Yeah. So, like me, you just say pave it and turn it into a.
I just don't know what, you know, that's just a tougher nut to crack. Like, I was talking to a science teacher here at TAM, and he was saying that his principal came to him one day and told him to stop teaching that evolution. The parents are complaining. Just stop teaching it, you know? The kids were already indoctrinated with anti-evolution creationist ideas, and he was maybe starting to make some progress with them, and then the principal was like, you just can't do this.
I'm just hoping that this will beat all of that out of them.
Yeah.
Kids are curious, and they want to know, and they'll look it up.
You hope so.
Hopefully.
You hope so. But the culture's hard. You know, culture is hard.
We're seeing a lot of things change, though, right? Yeah. So if you go from our father's generation to Steve's 16-year-old daughter's generation, I mean, she's just flat out not prejudiced.
Yeah.
Where you go back two generations and the people from the 50s. Now, I'm not saying universally, but there's a lot of prejudice in people from the 50s.
Right.
Yes. And Julia is just void of it. Completely doesn't care. Doesn't even notice.
Yeah, my daughter has none of it in her. They tried to teach it to me incidentally. They weren't meaning to do that. Yeah. Of course, you know. But the jokes that were not. That serve two purposes and not just the purpose of
being humorous.
Yeah,
we're of the same generation.
I'm 51.
Yeah, we're 50, 51.
My grandfather used to talk about how there was this. He had two black guys that worked down with him down on the railroad tracks there, and one of them was great, and the other one was just a dickhead. Yeah. You know, you got your good ones and your bad ones. I mean, that I grew up with that. And my stepdad was a racist that shot niggers in the ass with birdshot and that kind of talk. Jeez. And so I had to dispatch that.
Yeah.
And it was not even in my daughter. And so, that's changing big time.
And my grandmother was very racist, but my mom married a black man, and that's how I became me. And so my mom wasn't racist. I'm sure she was brought up to be that way, but she turned out to be something completely different.
And did that turn your grandma around?
No.
Damn, I keep hoping that we're going to connect, and I'm like,
never gave it up.
That's too bad.
It's really bizarre.
Think about like the gay and transgendered issue. Like
that's even, profound.
Like when we were kids, like you would make fun of people who were gay.
Oh, me too. I wrote a bit when I was a stand-up, and I was on the line. I mean, I wrote a bit about a girl. True story, actually, hitting on me in Guam, and the owner of the club comes up and goes, you know, that's a guy, and I'm like, well, I spent this money. Somebody's getting laid. So I was doing that kind of crisscross material.
But in my
head, I was like, you know, at the time, I was like, yeah, that's fucking awful. I don't want to do that.
Yeah.
But I already have my foot in that right material that kind of speaks to all of it, you know?
Yeah, I think like we're sort of the transitional generation maybe, but my daughter's generation, like gender, you know, sexual preference, it's like that's all individual. The idea that anybody would care or have anything to say
it's
about it
to
is not only foreign, it's repugnant.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
It's repugnant.
My daughter, too.
You know?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, so like they're fully there. Fully there.
I didn't
it's
even
awesome.
Know what racism awesome. Was when I until yeah. I went to school. So
this is, in a way that's
tell that story about the kid.
When I was in elementary school, I was... Okay.
We're going to do it in the premium version of the
well,
show.
Well, what happened was... Okay.
All right. I love this story. It's profound. And you're going to have some insights into this this mindset. Anyway, that's it, ladies and gentlemen, for the free version of episode 96, another show that went off without a hitch.
We miss you, Hitch.
We'll be making the full 90 minutes available to our premium subscribers very soon. If you'd like to hear the full 90-minute show, please go to skepticallyyours.net/premium and subscribe. I want to thank our guests, Dr. Stephen Novella, Robert Novella, Jay Novella, and Evan Barnstein. I also want to thank my co-hosts, Heather Henderson, and our camera switcher, Ryan Magnon. Tune in next week when our guests will be...
More People at TAM.
And we'll be talking about...
TAM sandwiches.
That's
our theme music, courtesy of the sound editor of The Aristocrats, Eric Wilson, and special thanks to our Wall of Reason moderator, Joseph Skeptic That We Miss, Swam, and our digital publicist and web guru, Cameron, guy who's always pissed, Winters.
And where can people find you guys?
TheSkepticsGuide.org.
That's easy enough.
For all of you.
Just go there. You'll find Twitter and everything. Right? Yeah, I know your Twitter handle. It's all right. Yeah. You've been listening to Skeptically Yours on SkepticallyYours.net. I'm your host, Emery Emery.
And I'm Heather Henderson.
And we are Skeptically Yours. Skeptically Yours is a product of an ever-expanding universe. Thanks, everybody.